Amid calls for defunding and dismantling police departments nationwide, Texas cities take up proposals for re-examining spending on law enforcement. That story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown, a tale of two cities both under pressure to change the calculus when it comes to policing and reform in the name of racial justice. We'll hear from reporters in Houston and Austin. Also, museums across Texas struggling to reopen after a pandemic lockdown. And love in the time of COVID-19, tech expert Omar Gallaga on how virtual matchups may outlive the virus. Those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway. Right after this. It's Texas Standard time on this Thursday, June 11th. I'm David Brown. Good to have you with us. Washington, D.C., 1962. Noting that law enforcement officers have been protecting the nation since its inception, John F. Kennedy signs a proclamation declaring the calendar week in which May 15th falls each year as National Police Week, and so it becomes forged into our national memory. But the truth is a bit more complicated. Early America typically relied on a for-hire, privately funded system that was for profit. Certain larger cities had a night watchman outside, mostly looking for gambling and prostitution, but that fell by the wayside due to dissatisfaction with a watchman falling asleep on the job, literally. And the job was hard to hire for, too, because the watchman had a bad reputation. Coupled with low pay, few wanted such a job. The first publicly funded police force that looked anything like what we think of it today was formed in Boston in the 1830s. Merchants in America's busiest port city had come up with a way to shift the costs of protecting their shipping businesses to the public at large, arguing that it provided for the common good. Gary Potter, a crime historian at Eastern Kentucky University, says that in the South, the justification was more the market for a certain kind of shipping, slaves. Public order, for the most part, depended on whom was asked. Later, the politics of labor affected policing, as did prohibition. Today, we have the most professionalized and highly trained police forces in our history. But as recent events suggest, many Americans now feel a time for a rethink of past assumptions is overdue. And that rethink is happening in Texas as it is across the nation. We begin today in our biggest city, where Houston Public Media's Jen Rice has been covering calls for a defunding of police there. Jen, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about what actually has been going on in Houston. As I understand it, there have been at least two public hearings and protests yesterday.
That's right. Yeah, so yesterday, Houston City Council met and they passed the fiscal year 2021 budget. The overall budget increases slightly by 1%, but what's getting a lot of attention is that they increased the police budget by about $30 million, and that was amid hundreds of protesters outside calling to defund the police. And, you know, for me, I was covering it inside and outside. I would go out and talk to the protesters and then inside and following the meeting. And it was just a fascinating exchange.
Do you have a sense of what kind of how much of the budget roughly goes toward funding the police department?
Sure. Yeah, this is a $5 billion budget and about $1 billion of that goes to HPD.
I see. Tell us about the protest outside City Hall yesterday. What were the protesters saying?
Yeah, so I spoke with the Black Lives Matter founder in Houston, Ashton Woods, and he was saying that he doesn't feel like the protesters are being heard. He's calling for a decrease in police funding, whereas, you know, the mayor and all of the council members did unanimously pass this budget with a police increase.
We should probably talk a little bit about the meaning of defunding police, because that also has been what some have called for in Houston and elsewhere. What are activists meaning by that? Dismantling the police department? What is it that you heard from protesters when it comes to what they want done with the budget and with Houston police?
It's my understanding that what they want is for cities to redirect money into community services, into neighborhoods, you know, the public health department, for instance, since we're in this global pandemic right now. So they're calling out this, what they see as a discrepancy between the amount of money that's going to police, where they say they're not seeing results. And in fact, some communities are saying they feel harmed by the police. So I think, you know, in the big picture, they're calling for a gradual incremental decline in how much money goes to police departments, and also at the same time, or an investment, you know, redirecting that money into other departments.
Does this appear to be something that is a call citywide, just from these protesters? What's your sense of how the people of Houston are feeling about these calls for defunding the police and shifting those resources elsewhere?
I will say, from my time covering city council, this is really an unusual amount of participation. I know, you know, Austin city council meetings can go on for hours and hours and hours. Houston council meetings don't. And this is kind of astonishing. Like, to see hundreds of people protesting outside City Hall during a council meeting is abnormal. To see, you know, 100 people sign up to speak at public session is abnormal. This is not the typical situation here in Houston. So to me, what I'm seeing is just a lot of people showing up who normally don't. And that to me feels like they're saying that a lot of people are supporting protesters here.
So is the city council vote on the budget the final word? Where does it stand? And what about police reform?
Yeah, so it's sort of the question is about the timeline. One council member wanted to put police reform on the budget this week and have that passed this week, whereas it looks like what's going to happen is the mayor's convening a task force, and there might be recommendations within, you know, more like 90 days. And in the past, he's called task forces together for things like looking at the Confederate monuments that are in Houston. And protesters told me, you know, we haven't seen results from that yet. So they're not optimistic that this task force will be any different.
Jen Rice is a reporter for Houston Public Media. Jen, thanks.
Thank you.
Now we turn our attention to the Texas capital city, where Mose Bouchel has been following a quite similar story for our home station of KUT. Mose, welcome back to The Standard.
Hey, David.
Before we get to the budget situation, what exactly are you hearing from protesters who have been in the streets demanding racial justice and police reform?
Well, obviously, there are a whole slew of demands, police accountability, changes in police practices. But one of the big ones does go back to this funding. It's about defunding the police. That's kind of the catchphrase that you hear a lot of protesters using, although, of course, it's a little more complicated than that.
And just how seriously are Austin City Council members hearing those calls? I mean, are they taking steps to do anything along those lines?
They are. In fact, today they're moving forward with a whole bunch of different resolutions that could end up taking a sizable amount of money away from the Austin Police Department and moving it into other areas of city governance and kind of social services that protesters and city council members alike think will kind of further public safety rather than funding the police.
It's my understanding that, in fact, one of the police associations here in Austin was sending texts out saying that Austin might be taking a vote to defund the police. And it sounded a bit like they might actually remove all funds. That's likely not to happen, I would imagine.
Yeah, we got to be careful about it. I mean, obviously, different people are framing this different ways, but these calls to defund the police, at least the way they're being taken at City Hall, it's really just about different budgets, right? What city council members are talking about is taking about $100 million, that's the figure they've been using, away from the police budget and putting it, as I said, into other areas. Now, the police budget in Austin is sizable. Depending on how you look at it, it can make up to about 40% of the entire city's general fund. It's something like $440 million allocated last year to the police budget. So what they're talking about is $100 million of that to go to other areas.
What are some of the proposals? I mean, are they trying to link this to reform, or is this just a reallocation of funds? What are you hearing?
I mean, there's so much going on today. It's almost hard to keep track of. But when it comes to the money, yes, they want to reallocate it into things like mental health services, housing security, areas that they say will answer some of the root causes that may lead to police interactions with people and may provide more public safety than than just putting that money into police. But again, there are a lot of other proposals on the table. There's a vote of no confidence going on about police leadership. City council members seem fed up with the police chief. There's a proposal to essentially audit the amount of money that goes into settlements with police over police misconduct cases. You know, every year cities pay out settlements when police have been accused of misconduct. They want to see exactly how much of that money is being spent every year. I could go on and on, but there really are. It's a whole bunch of different proposals, and it appears to have widespread support at City Hall.
Widespread support at City Hall. Do any of these proposals seem likely to satisfy protesters? Is this the sort of change that they're demanding?
I mean, it is in line with a lot of what you're hearing on the streets, but even some of the city council members say this is just a first step. People are talking about a real kind of systemic overhaul of the way that law enforcement is imagined. And so the city council members who have brought these resolutions forward say this is not the end. It's really just the beginning.
Any idea of how the vote might go?
Yeah, it appears as though it has widespread support. Throughout the last week, we've seen more and more city council members come on as sponsors for all of these different resolutions, to the point where it seems like a foregone conclusion now. Although, of course, as you know, things get up on the dais, people start talking, offering resolutions, you know, things can change. But it does appear to have widespread support.
Mos Bouchel continues to cover a developing story for KUT in Austin, our home station. Mos, thanks so much, and keep us posted.
Thank you, David.
Joining us once again on this Thursday, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hi there, Wells. What do you see?
Hi, David. Thursday already. How'd that happen?
Yeah.
Well, we're hearing about the push to defund the police, which, as we've just been exploring, means more than slashing budgets. Instead, it's a rethinking of policing and the huge resources it receives in comparison to other city services. Here are some of the resources, or rather the responses we're seeing on our Facebook page. Tyler Malloy says, if resources were reallocated for prevention, like mental health services, education, job training, and drug counseling, we wouldn't need so many police or prisons. And Marcel says, a person with a baton and a gun doesn't have the tools to properly address a person in the middle of a mental health crisis. We need a better system, and we can't afford it. And Stephen St. Clair says, we need to try this out now. If it fails, change it back. But we need to change this right now. Additionally, David, many people taking issue with that term defund, as y'all were just exploring a few moments ago. Meg Hertz says the word defunding is inaccurate. The motivation behind it is spot on. Help people before there is a crisis and create safe places in hospitals instead of putting sick people in jail. And Laurel Lee James calls it a bad name for a good move. Those are a range of the reactions we're seeing on this issue taking hold in cities across Texas and the nation. Just one story we're watching. So I'll be back with more later in the program.
Wells Dunbar will join us once again in about 35 minutes or so here on The Standard. Interesting issue about that defunding, and a lot of confusion over what such a thing would mean. Quite often people talk about defunding in terms of taking resources from law enforcement and shifting them over to other important aspects of community services. We'd like to hear what you think about this conversation. You know what to do, right? Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells will be joining us with more of your comments. It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Shifting to another big story right now, the ongoing fight against COVID-19. Nearly 2,000 deaths in Texas so far, and this week a spike in hospitalizations. A large percentage of people hospitalized with COVID-19 have pre-existing chronic illnesses like diabetes or heart disease, but people with other conditions like HIV or AIDS could also be at greater risk due to the coronavirus. KERA's Galilee Abdullah has been hearing from groups in Dallas that work with people with HIV and AIDS.
Antoine Wiley is the founder of AIDS Walk South Dallas, and he's been HIV positive for 27 years. He says that the pandemic has changed a lot of things, but people who are immunocompromised are normally cautious.
These are things that we do all the time, except for the 6 feet and the mask.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says there's no specific information about the risk of COVID-19 to those living with HIV or AIDS. Dr. Jason Gilman is an infectious disease specialist with Prism Health North Texas, a group that works with people affected by HIV or AIDS. Gilman says about 20 of his patients who are HIV positive have tested positive for COVID-19, but that they've mostly been mild cases.
A lot of our patients, you know, 90% of them, their HIV is well controlled. They're undetectable. They have normal T-cell counts. So their immune system is pretty comparable to, you know, anyone else out there.
COVID-19 has led some people to avoid seeking medical treatment. But advocates say people who may have been exposed to HIV or AIDS or sexually transmitted infections should still seek treatment and get tested. JP Cano is Prevention Services Manager at Resource Center in Dallas. Cano says the Resource Center's clinic that provides HIV and STI testing continue to test people through April and May.
Because you don't want somebody to have HIV first, they don't know their status, and at the hospital with COVID.
People with HIV or AIDS who are low income or homeless are especially vulnerable right now. Traswell Livingston is president of AIDS Services of Dallas, which provides housing and support services to low-income and homeless people living with or affected by HIV/AIDS. Livingston says the pandemic has led the agency to adjust several of its services to reduce face-to-face interactions.
We put in some restrictions on traffic and visitors and just outside public non-essential engagement to the property.
People served by AIDS Services of Dallas were already vulnerable before the pandemic. Medication is expensive, and people without the resources may not be able to afford the medicine to control their HIV or AIDS. Some have other illnesses, too. So Livingston says, in the face of a pandemic, support is even more important.
As far as compromised immune systems, 100% of our residents are in that space and are low income. Our average income for our residents is around $9,900 a year.
Antoine Wiley, the founder of AIDS Walk South Dallas, says his group has also had to adjust during the pandemic. They have monthly educational seminars, support groups, and they offer financial assistance for people living with HIV/AIDS. Most clients are Black men in Southern Dallas.
We're doing a lot of virtual. Even for some clients, we do drive-bys where we talk to them from their front door, from their patio, from their balcony, and make sure that they have what they need.
Wiley wants his clients to feel supported, even if they can't see each other in person.
To make sure that we stay connected, to let them know that they are not forgotten.
Wiley says the pandemic postponed his group's AIDS walk. It's now set for September. He's hopeful it'll happen because people are yearning to gather in person. I'm Galilee Abdullah in Dallas.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Dating. For singles, it's another of the many areas of their lives that has been changed dramatically by the coronavirus pandemic. Places people meet, like restaurants and bars, are beginning to reopen, but there's no clear path back to what was once normal dating culture. Never fear, our tech expert Omar Gayaga says the companies that make online dating apps, several of which are based right here in Texas, are quickly changing up their offerings to respond to social distancing and safety concerns, even as some virtual daters in Texas are getting restless. Omar, welcome back.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me.
Seems like there's an oxymoron here, dating with social distancing. How does this work exactly?
Well, I mean, the dating apps, you know, I've definitely been working to try to accommodate this culture of distancing. You know, we have a lot of them based in Texas, like Bumble is based in Austin. Mm-hmm. We have a bunch of them owned by the Dallas-based Match Group, like Tinder, Hinge, Plenty of Fish. And they have been, you know, incorporating things like more video chat options for users or reintroducing some of those features. Kara Carlson at the Austin American-Statesman had a really good roundup on in the Sunday paper about kind of how they're adapting and what they're doing. But a lot of it amounts to what you would expect. They are trying to create virtual experiences for people that are leery of meeting in person. But even that is starting to shift, I'm hearing, is that even that in the last couple of weeks is starting to move away from the virtual stuff in the Zoom.
Oh, that's interesting. What does virtual dating amount to, actually? Are you just sort of meeting each other on a Zoom-like app, or what does that amount to?
Yeah, that can be everything from messaging, which, you know, has had an uptick, to video messaging or video, you know, live chats, which have, you know, we've seen everywhere from work to education and then also dating. You're also seeing some creative stuff like Bumble has a partnership with Airbnb to do these virtual curated dates where it's more like, you know, an online magic show that you watch together, or a distant wine tasting where you're each, you know, drinking the same bottle of wine, you know, separately. The thing is, you know, how long is that sustainable? Are people getting kind of, people are already getting burned out on Zoom for work and for school.
Yeah.
Are people starting to get tired of it for dating?
And it seems to me that you've got some other competition in the fact that restaurants and bars are reopening. And by competition, I mean competition away from virtual dating. There just happen to be some other options right now.
I spoke to a founder, Zachary Kessler, who has a new app called The Round. This is like his second dating app that he's helped create in the Austin area. And he told me, you know, straight up, you know, people are going out. People are starting to date without the distancing. You know, maybe they're going on an outside date where they're taking a walk, you know, 6 feet away, but they are getting out of the house. They're tired of being of doing the virtual stuff. So, you know, he says that Texas is very different from other states right now. There are people here going out and ignoring some of the social distancing guidelines. So, you know, like it or not, people are using these apps to meet up.
You know, it's interesting because this reminds me of how so many times people look to high tech to overcome some of the obstacles. And certainly Zoom and other video conferencing apps went a long way toward trying to bridge the gap in other fields of human endeavor. Education comes to mind, obviously. But I wonder what your take is on whether or not virtual dating apps will ever really stick.
I think so. I think there are still going to be people who want to stay home who are not quite ready to go out and meet new people in person. And then you're seeing things like, I mean, The Round is planning to incorporate a feature that would, you know, give your STD and COVID-19 status, you know, and have it,
wow,
you know, official, you know, on your dating profile, so people would know that you've been tested for COVID-19. So things like that. I mean, I see that on the horizon more, and I see, you know, people wanting to slowly test the waters and maybe not dive in. But, you know, as we know, Texas is a little bit different from the rest of the country and things like this. And people are, seems like people are being a little bit more adventurous and getting out there more quickly than maybe in other parts of the country.
Hey, listeners, doesn't Omar Gallaga sound like the kind of guy you'd like to meet up with? Well, you
not
can.
On a dating app.
You can over at techminutetexas.com.
Don't piss off my girlfriend.
Omar, good to talk with you. See you next week.
Thank you, David. Be safe out there.
You too. We're fast approaching 29 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. What does a march for us by us actually mean? We're going to hear from one of the organizers about an extraordinary effort to get people in his community to come together. That's coming up right after the Texas Roundup here on The Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. President Trump is hosting a roundtable on race relations and policing in Dallas this afternoon ahead of a fundraiser. The meeting at a local megachurch will include faith leaders, law enforcement officials, and small business owners. Meanwhile, fellow Republican John Cornyn plans to convene his own roundtable on policing reforms in Dallas Friday. The U.S. Senator, who's up for re-election, will be joined by Dallas's mayor, as well as members of the Dallas Police Department and the local police union. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has denied an appeal to declare a major disaster in North Texas after strong winds and a tornado tore through the area last year. KERA's Becca Moore reports.
FEMA denied Governor Greg Abbott's appeal to declare a major disaster in parts of North Texas that were damaged after being hit by straight-line winds and an EF3 tornado last October. FEMA's response to Abbott's appeal said the impact of the storms wasn't severe enough to warrant a major disaster declaration. A statement from Dallas Mayor Eric Johnson in response said he's stunned and disappointed by the agency's decision. He said it, quote, leaves Dallas taxpayers on the hook for tens of millions of dollars in damage while managing a pandemic. I'm Becca Moore in Dallas.
A Honduran teenager seeking asylum can remain in the U.S. so a federal judge can hear his case. The boy picked up in Texas last week was set for deportation under the Trump administration's policy blocking all asylum seekers at the U.S. border to prevent the spread of COVID-19. American Civil Liberties Union attorney Lee Gelernt says the policy violates his client's right to due process.
The judge has made clear that he wants to receive submissions from the parties and hold a hearing, and that the boy should not be removed before then.
Gelernt says the judge, who temporarily blocked the 16-year-old's deportation Tuesday, is expected to schedule a hearing for late June. The Texas Commission on Environmental Quality has declared an Ozone Action Day for several parts of the state. That includes the Beaumont, Port Arthur, Dallas-Fort Worth, and Houston areas. Residents with underlying health conditions are urged to stay inside today to limit their exposure. TCEQ meteorologist Wesley Copeland says drivers can take steps to help reduce ground-level air pollution, including
limiting driving and idling, the timing of when they refuel their vehicle. It's more favorable to wait until late afternoon or evening. Just basically trying to decrease your overall contribution to what could result in additional ozone formation.
Unhealthy ozone levels are also forecast for the Austin and San Antonio areas on Friday. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Bitaway, a chemical-free treatment alternative to instantly relieve the itch and pain caused by insect bites. Portable, reusable, and no mess. Suitable for children. Learn more at TakeTheBiteAway.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. For us, by us. That was the idea that led a group of black activists with different nonprofits around Austin to organize a peaceful march starting at an historically black university in a city where the black population is dwindling. Reese Hurd II is one of those activists. He's the co-founder of the nonprofit organization Dream Out Loud Experience. He and a group of other activists around the city organized a march from Houston Tillotson University to the Capitol on Sunday. Reese, thanks for joining us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Could you tell us how this all came about? Take us back to how it all got started.
It all kind of happened just kind of out of nowhere. And it was a combination of what's going on in the world with the police brutality across the country. Also, Juneteenth was coming up, but that it was possibly going to be canceled in Austin. So myself, along with some other community activists, got together. We sat down just last week and we said, hey, what can we do? There was a march that was organized the previous weekend that got canceled. So we pulled in Chaz Moore and we told him that we had this concept of wanting to do something to where what was supposed to happen the previous weekend happens this following weekend. So we sat down with him and we came together and we brought all our resources in, and which that's what you saw.
One of the things that was really striking about this and distinctive about this march in particular was making sure it was centered around the black community in Austin. For us, by us was what the flyer said. Tell us more about that and how that manifested during the protest.
Well, here in Austin, we've noticed that, you know, there's been a lot of protesting going on, but at the same time, we didn't see a whole lot of us. You know, we saw some of us in the crowds and, you know, at some of these protest sites, but we just felt like we didn't see enough of Black Austin out speaking on Black Austin issues.
Why not? What do you think was going on? What was the dynamic there?
I think it was a combination of things. People still, you know, kind of afraid to be around other people because of COVID. And then I just think within the Black community, on issues like this, we don't always tend to come out to let our voices be heard. And I can't really speak to why that is. But what I can say is that there's a shift going on to where, you know, as the days and weeks go on, more and more Black people out of the community are standing up and they're speaking up, which is very important.
In fact, thousands of people showed up for your march and marched peacefully. Looking back at it now, the size of the crowd, the participation, what do you make of it all? What's going through your mind?
To me, it just shows the power in people, what we can do together when we come together. This was an idea on a Tuesday. We sat down on a Friday to iron out the details, And Sunday, you had thousands on top of thousands on top of thousands. And it was every color, men, women, children. It was beautiful. So on something like this, it just showed me that when we all come together, we can really change the world. I was just so keen on trying to change my world here in Austin, Texas. But seeing how myself along with my peers came together, we were literally able to touch the world. It went everywhere. So it's power in numbers. And we're all on the same page.
How do you capitalize on the moment and the momentum, really, to make change or to continue it?
We're actually in the process of doing that right now. Myself, along with those same community activists, are sitting down with the mayor to iron out some details to where we can make some changes for Black Austin and get some stuff in black and white on paper, hopefully get some funding. And we're going to try to make a real change to where hopefully we can be a blueprint for the rest of the country on ways that they can bring in the Black community and improve the Black community.
Reese, I'm told that these marches have actually taken something of a physical toll on you.
They have. They have. My voice has left me. It's starting to come back. It was a lot worse than this, but I've also had an ankle injury to where my ankle was sprained. Not this past weekend, but the weekend prior outside of APD, we were shot at. We were tear gassed. So in the process of trying to flee, not being able to see, sprain my ankle real bad, running into like a ditch.
I hope you're healing up fast. You doing better?
Yes, sir. I am. I'm walking better. Like I said, my voice is coming back to me. So nothing that a little honey and a little tea can't fix.
Reese Hurd II is the co-founder of the nonprofit organization Dream Out Loud Experience and one of the co-organizers of a grassroots march last weekend billed as For Us, By Us. Reese, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, dedicated to the fight against cancer through telemedicine, providing patients with the ability to conduct online virtual appointments. More at texasoncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. For the most part, the Texas COVID guidelines allow visits to restaurants, stores, even zoos, albeit with some restrictions. But it's been over a month since Governor Abbott permitted limited reopenings for Texas museums, and the great majority of them remain closed. Jerome Weeks of KERA North Texas looks into why.
It's a sunny Saturday, a prime time for visiting art. At the Museum of Biblical Art in Dallas, the entrance door has a paper sign. It reads, "For admission, please twist the doorbell."
Welcome to the museum.
Thank you.
The museum's executive director, Scott Peck, introduces himself. "I'm only the third visitor today." Since reopening in May, the museum's daily attendance has varied widely. On Mother's Day, it was 22. Pre-pandemic, that would have been hundreds. Peck himself isn't wearing a face mask, though he reminds visitors about safety precautions. But when you're the only person wandering past video displays, social distancing isn't hard. The same is true in East Texas at the Tyler Museum of Art. Christopher Leahy is the executive director.
When we opened, we had a week of kind of watching to see how it worked, and we haven't had a problem with it. We've had a small but steady stream of visitors.
Our human tendency to crowd around that one favorite artwork has worried museums hoping to reopen safely. But Leahy says visitors seem content to keep their distance themselves. So, why haven't more museums risked reopening when stores and hair salons have? Well, we think visiting a museum means just looking and walking. But that doesn't consider the different environments we wander through. Cafes, sculpture gardens, restrooms, gift shops. Simply putting up a sneeze shield at a cash register won't guarantee safety. What's more, the Tyler Museum has two galleries, easily monitored. Fort Worth's Modern Art Museum has 14, with a dozen sub-galleries. Dustin Van Orn is the museum's marketing director. He says the Modern can't afford a guard in every gallery.
There's still a lot of things that we have to figure out
We're also working with a lot of the other museums and trying to create a uniform experience for visitors so that everybody can understand what to expect.
Museums across the country have been sharing ideas to keep staff and visitors safe. Houston's Museum of Fine Arts, one of the largest to reopen, requires face masks and checks visitors' temperatures. But reopening involves another major headache. Basically, the museum's supply chain has jammed. SMU's Meadows Museum had a landmark show of Alonso Berruguete's art set to open March 29th. The 16th century Spanish artist worked with Michelangelo himself, yet this would be the first major show of his artworks in the U.S. ever. But as the opening approached, Meadows officials were racing the coronavirus. Mark Roglin is director of the Meadows.
Most of the exhibition was already installed, and one of the paintings made one of the last flights that left Rome before all the airports were shut in Italy.
Their luck didn't hold. Dallas shut down. Roglin got on the phone and asked museums if they'd extend their loans. So the Meadows now has a sizable collection of old masters, locked in its galleries until September when SMU reopens. Museums like the Meadows, ones that host major tours, they're part of a network of collectors, galleries, and artists' estates. When one museum can't return artworks or must close a show early, that can domino through the system, wrecking plans that took years to make. The Modern's Dustin Van Horn.
We have a lending structure, and I think that this whole COVID situation has thrown a wrench into that schedule for everyone.
Jeremy Strick is director of the Nasher Sculpture Center.
For our part, we've effectively moved the clock back a year.
Three museums in Dallas had windows broken during protests, but officials say that hasn't seriously affected their reopening plans, possibly for next month. Amy Lewis Hofflin, director of the Crow Museum of Asian Art, says she's waiting for 2 weeks of declining COVID infections. Until then, the museums will continue setting up timed tickets to limit crowds, and they'll stockpile hand sanitizers, masks, and gloves in preparation for the visitors who've yet to come. In Dallas, I'm Jerome Weeks.
I remember when I met him. I remember what he said when he came into the studio as if he needed a formal introduction. Hi, I'm James. James Hand from West Texas.
There are times I know just who I am and what I want to be. Till a raging river climbs the dam to come crashing down on me.
I knew the place as that town with the kolaches just off I-35. But to be more precise, he was from Tokyo, a small town just east of West. Directions like that might not sit well in an age of GPS, but James Hand never lost his bearings.
Well, I'm dreaming tonight of Texas, cotton fields and whippoorwill. Where I used to live and wander through the rocks and all the hill. I can see my dear little mama as around the place she go. At my home down in Texas, a little bit east of Tokyo.
In a cowboy hat and an embroidered shirt with a vocal quiver that always seemed about to slide into an easy yodel, Hand was often compared to Hank Williams, and any Texas honky-tonk seemed like home whenever he took the stage. He didn't like the comparisons to the greats. I'm just James Hand, he'd say. When James Hand died on June 8th, the cause was unannounced. He was 67, or maybe 68, no one seems quite sure. James Hand had been singing all his life, but he didn't record his first album until 1999, when he was in his late 40s. That album, indeed all of his recordings, so sincere and straightforward, that descriptions like hardcore country do a disservice.
Jukebox. My favorite mourners and I talk about these old hard knocks.
Life wrote the songs, he once told an interviewer. All I have to do is remember the words. But the word most used to describe James Hand was authentic. Willie once called him the real deal. I once asked him what song influenced him the most. Without pausing to think, he said Houston by Dean Martin. See, we used to have an old cistern in the backyard. Cistern. You know, one of those great big old tanks to hold water, and it was always dry. When I was a little boy, I'd go out there and lie on my back looking up and sing that Houston song like Dean Martin did on the records, with the echoes and whatnot. And I'd dream I'd be a singing star someday.
going back to Houston, Houston, Houston.
In between gigs, he'd spent some time as a horse trainer and later as a truck driver. I like the speed, he said, not exactly explaining, but letting it just sit out there for a moment. And then, as if to answer the question before it could be asked, he looked down and then up again. I ain't nobody's role model. I've done a lot of bad things I ain't proud of. But I'm glad I got my music and people like you. And by you, it was as if he really meant you. As if that was what really mattered most.
I drink too much, I'm too proud. I'm an easy touch and I'm too dang loud.
It wasn't uncommon for James Hand to make the rounds of the tables during a set break, offering a personal hello and a hearty thanks for coming to every person in the room. But he also wanted to know your name, where you were from, and I can hear him repeat it out loud in that drawl, like he could hardly believe it himself that people would come from far and wide to see him perform. But after all, a James Hand show was never a show. You came for the real deal, earnest and unpretentious. Simple stories of heartbreak, hard times, and a longing for the promise of heaven, straight from the heart of Texas, West Texas. Just a bicycle ride away from a lonely cistern in Tokyo.
Here lies a good old boy who loved to laugh and live.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Pete Gallego has spent much of his professional life representing West Texas. The Alpine native was a member of the Texas House of Representatives for over 20 years, then spent one term representing Texas's 23rd District in the U.S. House, an area that stretches all the way from San Antonio to El Paso. Now he's taking on a new challenge out west, serving as president of his alma mater, Sul Ross State University in Alpine. President Gallego, congratulations and welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much. It is a pleasure to be here, and I'm very excited about the opportunity to be president of Sul Ross.
Well, of course, a lot of people remember you having served in the Texas and U.S. House of Representatives for over 20 years, and you live in one of the few U.S. House districts in Texas that has proven to be truly competitive, as you well know.
Absolutely.
What was it about this opportunity at Sul Ross that was more attractive than, say, running for office again, which I think a lot of people asked questions about repeatedly?
You know, I was never very good at the yelling and the screaming and the pointing fingers. I just like to build and fix and make better. And this opportunity is exactly that. It is an opportunity to make sure that people have a chance to improve their lives through education. And I want to make sure that for those people who want to do different things, to dream big, those opportunities are there, and they begin here at Sul Ross.
You are taking this job at a time when COVID-19 has made colleges and universities reevaluate how they do business. How will the coronavirus change things at Sul Ross right now and going forward?
Well, we're going to open on a timely basis. Our dorms are going to be open. We're going to proceed with the CDC guidelines of social distancing. We've already been going through each building and marking off the spaces so that we have classrooms that are essentially going to be at 50% capacity to make sure that kids are safe. And in addition to that, we're front-loading essentially all of our courses, so that all of the lab work, all of the in-person work gets done before Thanksgiving. And then after Thanksgiving, we're switching to a remote period so that if you've gone back to Houston or Dallas or San Antonio or Austin or wherever you're from, New York or L.A., you don't have to worry about coming back. And that way we keep our COVID numbers down. Let me step back a minute. Sure. I don't think that higher education in 10 years is going to look anything like higher education 5 or 6 months ago.
Really?
I think this is a transformational period, and I think there will be a lot of changes along the way, that COVID has kind of shown us that we can do things in a different manner. I frankly think that will be also a factor in keeping costs down. But I also know that students, if you look at student surveys pretty much across the board, Students want a college experience. They want to be on a campus. And so to that end, for those people who actually want to come here, we've got to provide not only a quality education, but a memorable experience.
Of course, there are a lot of young people with issues of civil rights and racial injustice on their minds right now. And in fact, earlier this week, we spoke with a Sol Ross student who helped organize a Black Lives Matter protest in Alpine. I'm wondering, how do you as a president plan to use that position to be a force for anti-racism on campus and in the community?
Well, you know, I have my family actually has a history, a long history in the civil rights fight, particularly out here. I'm very passionate about constitutional rights. I was really excited to see that because I will tell you that when I was in college here, there was a lot of apathy on campus, and you would not have seen very much enthusiasm. And I think the young people of today are definitely paying more attention. The rural areas, there's still some strong voices out here. And so I expect to use my platform to encourage that, to encourage participation, to make sure that this is not only a center of learning, but also an area that welcomes diversity of thought, diversity of opinion, and encourages these conversations about how we can have a better society for everyone here in the United States.
Pete Gallego is a former member of the Texas and U.S. Houses of Representatives. He is also an alumnus of Sol Ross State University and now its newest president. President Gallego, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard. Pleasure to get to meet you.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. The new top logo, I said logo, didn't I? Lobo, that's what I should have said there, over at Sol Ross University. That's quite a thing.
And yeah.
He's a former great alum,
campus.
Too. So that's the voice of our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Wells, what are you hearing out there in social media land?
Well, we're watching a couple of different stories. Here's an update to one we heard yesterday. This the troubling story of how a black man in Central Texas, Williamson County, died at the hands of police being repeatedly tased after he failed to dim his headlights at an oncoming police car. This is the 2019 story of Javier Ambler, which is just now coming to light thanks to the dogged reporting from the Austin American Statesman's Tony Plahetsky. And adding another layer to this tragedy is the fact that a camera crew from Live PD, this reality TV program, was there filming it. They've since said that they have destroyed the footage. Now a new development, Live PD has said that it is ceasing production altogether. As the country sort of rethinks its relationship with policing in the midst of these civil rights protests. Lots of people talking about this decision and really moreover talking about the fact that footage is missing. Really remarkable turn of events. Via Facebook, Charles Scott says, "Surely they knew they were destroying evidence. Nobody films the death of another human, then destroys it unless there's something nefarious taking place." So raising some very troubling questions, obviously, there, David. Another interesting thing to note here is that the long-running reality TV show Cops has also announced it's ceasing production after something like three decades. Really a sort of a forerunner of all this reality TV programming that we see today. Well, we're continuing to monitor the spike in COVID-19 cases in Texas as well. I believe we were setting some new records yesterday for a number of hospitalizations and new cases, I do believe. Alicia Ann Trotter on our Facebook page. She says, from the start of this, they said Texas wouldn't start peaking until late May or June, so this isn't a shock. She goes on to call it stupid for opening up prior to the peak and adds that no state has followed the guidelines for proper opening. So again, we're going to continue to see some of these numbers rise, I think, as was predicted by some of the epidemiologists and people studying this stuff ever since Texas reopening, so to speak, over Memorial Day weekend. Obviously, a story where with a lot of impact here that is being bandied about on social media. And continuing to hear about that story at the top of the show, back and forth, rather, on how to approach police funding or whether or not these calls to defund the police are gaining traction. Jimmy's Dito on our Facebook page takes a contrary opinion. He says Dallas is already short police and they're diverting funds elsewhere. Has everyone lost their minds? So not everyone on board with this provocative call to rethink police funding.
And of course, this is far from the last word on that story as well. It's one we continue to track here at The Standard. We're out of time for the broadcast, but the news continues over at texasstandard.org. We hope you can join us again tomorrow.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.